Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois. We're back for another wonderful episode, and I have with me Jim Cassidy, who serves as the pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim. It's good to talk to you today.
As always, Camden, great to be here. Great day for a good conversation. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, we also have with us Glenn Clary, who's the pastor of Providence OPC in Pflugerville, Texas, nearby just in the northern side of Austin. Welcome back, Glenn. It's good to have you with us today as well.
Thank you very much, Camden. It's good to be here.
And we're also welcoming today, for the very first time, someone in the area of Jim and Glenn. We're welcoming Keith Stanglin, Dr. Stanglin, who is the associate professor, or one of the associate professors, at the Austin Graduate School of Theology. He's done much work on Arminius and has finished and completed a PhD at Calvin Seminary several years ago. And we're welcoming him to the program today to speak with us about none other than Arminius. Welcome to the program, Keith. It's good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Camden. Very good to be here.
Yeah, we got to meet Keith down at the theology conference we held in Austin a few months ago, back in April, and we're looking forward to speaking with Keith today about Arminius. He's written not only a lengthy dissertation and a very important and significant dissertation, I believe it's been published with Brill, but also several other journal articles on the subject, important things that you're going to want to check out, one of which is in the Westminster Theological Journal, Volume 67 from 2005, his article, Arminius avant les lettres, Peter Barrow, Jacob Arminius, and the Bond of Predestinarian Polemic. I also have before me another article that is absolutely fascinating. One titled The New Perspective on Arminius, Notes on a Historiographical Shift, Reformation and Renaissance Review, that was published back in 2009. Another excellent article. So we're looking forward to speaking about Arminius and the proper understanding of him historically and theologically. But before we get into that, I do want to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported, and we do rely on all the generous support of our listeners and viewers to help us produce and distribute all of our programs and resources free of charge. You can visit us online today at reformedforum.org to pledge your support. While you're there, I also encourage you to visit our conference page, reformedforum.org/conference, for information about how to register and attend our conference in the fall. October 7th through 9th, 2016, we'll be having our third annual conference here at Hope OPC in Grays Lake, just a little bit north of Chicago, not too far from O'Hare Airport. We'd love to have you here with us. If you can drive here, if you can fly here, in whatever way possible, we're going to be speaking about the image of God. So an important subject, and we're looking forward to having another wonderful time. It'll be our fourth conference, our third annual, you know, regular national conference, but our fourth overall, and we're all going to be here hoping that you will be able to join us as well. All that's available online at reformedforum.org/conference. Well, guys, it's great to be here today and to speak about this subject. Some people might be wondering, what the heck? What's going on at Reformed Forum? We're going to be talking about Arminius. That's right. It's important. And so certainly many people know who Arminius was, that being the Latinized name. And they will have some idea, at least, of what he taught. But, of course, there can be many, many misconceptions. And Keith has done much work in helping us to understand who Arminius was and what he taught theologically much more accurately, because we can have faulty conceptions that are often driven by dogmatic concerns. Keith, as we begin today, I'm wondering if you might be able to open up for us a little bit of biography, and not just of Arminius telling us who he was in his context, but specifically your own history and path into academic research and study. What brought you to speak and to study and to teach on Arminius?
I can say a little bit, yeah, about my interest in church history in general. I wanted to go into studying church history, and am interested in all periods of history from about as early as I can remember my academic life. So I was interested particularly in the 17th 18th century Reformed history, just as a background for much of American church history. Initially, when I went into my PhD program, which, as you said, I did at Calvin Theological Seminary, So I was there with Richard Muller, who was my advisor, talking about possible dissertation topics my first semester there at Calvin. And he was very open to doing something on sort of intellectual backgrounds of American church history, but admitted that he was not an expert in that area. He said we could do that and get someone from the college to serve on the committee who is an expert in American history. But he also suggested some other things that I might think about. He knew that I was not a confessional Calvinist, so he thought that I might enjoy working on Arminius. Now, at that time, I was about as knowledgeable about Arminius as I think most Christians are, sort of know the name.
Yeah.
I had never read Arminius at that point. I knew about him, but only from surveys, basically. So I considered that I needed to read some Arminius. It was either, I don't know if it was that day or that week, but it was very soon after that, before I had gotten a hold of his writings in the library, that I was in the Calvin Sim bookstore and noticed on the discount shelf there were the three volumes of Arminius's works in English from the old 19th century English translation on sale. For some reason, they weren't a hot item at Calvin Sim. So I saw the books there. I think they were like $15 for all three of them. Ooh. And can't get them for that now. So I bought them, took them home, and started reading Declaration of Sentiments and thought, this is really compelling stuff and probably someone I could spend some time on. So that's sort of how it started, you know, biographically for me. Just getting into Arminius. Here was somebody that people have at least heard of, but not much technical material has been written on him. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Muller himself had written a monograph on Arminius and was one of the best experts on Arminius, still is. So, it was a good place. Calvin was a great place to study Arminius, as it turns out, because of their library resources. Their collection, in his own Dutch Reformed background. So,
and I would imagine at a place like Calvin too, you probably didn't have a hard time getting the books at the library that you needed as well.
Yeah, that's right. The books are there. They have a great rare book collection as well, and then their interlibrary loan is second to none, as far as I know. I think it's the best place probably in North America to do that study. And then, of course, they have connections with the fatherland back over in Europe. And so I was able to do some dissertation research over there as well in Leiden, where Arminius lived and taught, to see some documents that were not available in North America. So, yeah,
Keith,
it was good.
Keith, would you be able to bring us into the book, which is now published and a published version of your dissertation? Maybe begin to introduce us into the contents and maybe something of the thesis that you're trying to drive home in the book.
So what I do in there, and this is sort of my revised dissertation, I think you mentioned, one thing is simply to try to set, the first half is setting the context of Arminius. As I said, not much technical theology or historical theology has been written on Arminius. So there was a lot to do just with sort of sorting through the popular level things and going back to his own academic context. Part of that is looking at disputations. What Arminius wrote, much of it was polemical because he was responding to charges, or he was responding to particular pamphlets, whether of William Perkins or other writings of his colleague Franciscus Homarus, or his predecessor Franciscus Junius at Leiden. And so to get at sort of his broader theology, since he did not write a systematic theology, the best place to go is to his disputations. And these are documents that are set in an academic context. So that got me into just wanting to set the context of the debate in the University of Leiden, where he taught for the last 6 years of his life. So I talk a lot about just what it was like to be colleagues on a faculty where pretty much everyone disagreed with him. So there were three theological faculty. You have two superlapsarians, the chair or the basically the rector of the theological college, also a superlapsarian, and then you have Arminius down the hall. So that, I think, lends some context to his resistance against superlapsarianism, because there were other options available then, of course, under the Reformed umbrella. But he saw every day, you know, when he came to work and had to sort of distinguish himself from and think about as an option. So that's part of it. The disputations I talk a little bit about as well, because it's unclear, for example, the authorship of the disputations when you just look at the documents themselves. So I did some research into that to see that, yes, Arminius is, as best we can tell, the author of these texts. And so they are good primary source material for getting into the broader aspects of his theology. All that sort of sets the background and foundation to talk about his doctrine of salvation. So I do essentially survey many aspects of his doctrine of salvation, but the second half of the book is really about the assurance of salvation. So I do all that to be able to talk about his doctrine of assurance. That is one of the, in my experience, the topics that Reformed and others who would teach unconditional predestination and perseverance of the saints look at Arminianism and see that as an attenuated way to be assured of salvation, if at all. Arminianism undermines assurance. So sort of with that in mind, thinking about why is it that Arminius pays very close attention to assurance and actually thinks that the way he teaches assurance provides better assurance of salvation for believers than his Reformed contemporaries could provide. So that was the sort of the summary, I suppose, of what I was getting at, and seeing how assurance of salvation really was one of the key motivations. It's not the center of his theology by any means, but it's certainly one of the key motivations for his, let's call it, descent from mainstream Reformed theology.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask a follow-up question about the disputation, and in particular, if Keith can explain to us what the Leiden debate was, what were the issues debated, and how was that important? How did this controversy begin?
Arminius came to, he was a pastor in Amsterdam, so for about 15 years. So he was actually a minister for more than twice the length of time he was a professor. So it's important, we may get to talk about it later, how that pastoral experience also shaped his theology. The majority of what he wrote was actually while he was a pastor. All that to say, when he came, when he was called to teach at Leiden, the oldest university in the northern Netherlands there, and it was the flagship seminary as well for the Dutch Reformed. When he was called to teach there, he was already a controversial figure because of some of his preaching, especially on the Book of Romans, that he was doing in the 1590s. But he came to Leiden in 1603 under a bit of a cloud of controversy, especially with his future colleague there, Franciscus Homarus. So he opposed Arminius at first, his calling there, but ended up approving of him coming in and was hoping that they could have a collegial relationship there. By February of 1604, Arminius conducted a disputation on predestination. And Comarus did not like the outcome. He didn't like what was said, what was defended in that disputation. And so by October, Comarus did a disputation of his own on predestination there in the Theological College. And it was pretty clear to everyone present, including Arminius, that this was a thinly veiled attack on Arminius. And so, in short, the debate happened pretty quickly. There was not much time for peace there. Within a few months, the controversy started at Leiden. And it was basically over predestination, doctrine of predestination, but also the doctrines that it is connected to. You can't say one thing about predestination without it also touching on other doctrines, doctrine of God, other things about doctrine of salvation, and so forth, including assurance. So that was the center of the debate throughout that happened among the theological faculty. But then, of course, as they teach students, some students will be more fans of Arminius. Others will be more adherents and disciples of the other faculty. And so the students debate these things, and the debates fairly quickly spill over into the Dutch churches. And it's not long before people realize, in fact, by 1656, middle of that decade, that this is something that is disturbing the churches as well. So there were attempts throughout this period to, by the states of Holland, to keep the debate civil, and especially within the university. Oh, these are academic questions that shouldn't divide us or separate us, so let's all get along. And when they could, the faculty tried to go along with that, but it was pretty clear that the debate wasn't going to stop. So that's what I mean by the Leiden debate. Those 6 years while Arminius was there, those doctrines really becoming an issue, and it's spilling over into the churches. So you had preachers taking sides for or against what Arminius was saying in Leiden, in Amsterdam, everywhere. Now, Arminius died in 1609 in good standing with the Reformed Church, and he had not been excommunicated or anything like that. But the debate continued, and that is, of course, the beginning in the 1610s of the so-called Remonstrant controversy, which culminated 10 years after Arminius' death in 1618 and 19 in the Synod of Dort and the rejection of Arminianism. But up to that point, at least the Arminians were engaged in that debate and hoping that their doctrine would be subsumed under the Reformed umbrella.
Now, maybe this is jumping ahead, I hope not, but I'd be curious because we've brought up several issues, and I'd like if maybe you can tie them together. We've brought up the issue of predestination. We brought up the issue of the assurance of salvation, which is kind of it's there in the title of the work. And then Arminius's pastoral concerns. Maybe Keith, you can tie together for us conceptually how those three things end up coming together, why it is that he addresses the doctrine of predestination the way he does in order to address the issue of ministering assurance of salvation in particularly a pastoral context.
There's an old story that Arminius was, now he did grow up in a Reformed context. He was trained under Reformed theologians, most significantly Theodore Beza, Calvin's successor in Geneva. But there's an old story that Arminius was basically a supralapsarian, or at least held the views of Beza, and then did an about-face, a direct sort of 180 turn on his views when he was asked to write a treatise on predestination. So he studied it more and so forth. Well, for various reasons, Arminius' main biographer from the 1970s, Carl Bangs, as well as Richard Muller, doubt the veracity of that story. So it's probable that Arminius always held to a sort of conditional predestination. And so it wasn't that he got in his ministry and now did this about face, but probably always opposed that. I think it was strengthened, though, his opposition to that was strengthened in his ministry, and as I said, also in his faculty academic context for just the people he was around. In his ministry, he notes that the Reformed doctrine of predestination, since it's unconditional, can lead to what he saw as two extremes. And Arminius is not the first to point this out. This is typical anti-Augustinian polemic. Erasmus says basically the same thing as well in his treatise on free choice back in 1524. Arminius probably was influenced by that as well. But the two extremes are, on the one hand, what he called security. So security means not, in English, it means sometimes a very good thing. Mostly in the Latin language, security is not a good thing. It means carelessness. Carelessness about something that you ought to care about. So sort of negligent carelessness. So in his ministry, he recalls several occasions where, as a good pastor, he would try to do his duty, and when someone was involved in sin that he knew about, he would go to that person individually and address that issue. And more often than not, more than he was comfortable with, the response to him would basically be a carelessness about sin and addressing it in their own lives. Hey, Arminius, you know, Paul even struggled with sin. Romans 7, you know, he was, sin indwells him, and he can't shake it. The good he wants to do, he doesn't do. So sort of get off my back about that. He thought that was not a mature Christian response, and the reason he attributed this to was this idea that if I'm elect, then I can't fall from grace, and this since I'm not saved by good works, then I'm not lost by sin, and so no big deal. So he thought that was not a good thing. On the other hand, he recalls when the plague came to Amsterdam toward the end of his ministry there, around 1602, two separate occasions where there were faithful believers that he was going to pray with and minister to who were on their deathbeds, who had no assurance of salvation at all, but were in complete despair. So he talks about despair as that other extreme. And of all people, these individuals, he said, should have been assured of their salvation. They were clearly believers who wanted to do good and were penitent. All the things you would look for as fruits of election, they had it. And at this time when they needed assurance most, they had none. He thought that is a result, a direct result, again, of unconditional reprobation, that if a person ever comes to the conclusion that I'm not elect, or I might not be elect, but there's nothing they can do on their end to become elect because it's unconditional on their part. And so it leads to a sort of despair. Even, I know that he talks about this, but of course the Reformed, Calvin himself, has a doctrine of temporary faith, so that even if at the moment you think you believe, you may be self-deceived. So he saw that as two certainly unintended consequences of Reformed soteriology and doctrine of predestination. Nevertheless, real things he saw in his ministry that led to an unhealthy, on both sides, unhealthy view of assurance for sanctification, for the life of sanctification.
And connected both of those to the doctrine of unconditional predestination, correct?
That's right. Yeah.
If I may ask just a follow-up question to be more specific about Arminius doctrine of the assurance of salvation. I'm wondering if, for Arminius, if assurance, if he thought that assurance was of the essence of saving faith. And of course, we know that some historians have made a pretty sharp distinction between Calvin and the Calvinist, and would argue that for Calvin, assurance was of the essence of faith, but for some Calvinists, it was not. But that assurance of salvation was a reflexive act of faith by which one would examine his life for evidences of saving faith, the so-called syllogismus practicus. And I'm wondering if you can comment on how did Arminius understand assurance and its relationship to saving faith? Was it of the essence of saving faith or something subsequent to it that came as a result of reflecting on your own life?
Yeah, he would line up more on distinguishing between faith, and not just distinguishing, but separating a little more faith from the assurance of salvation. Now, he would say, as soon as he would make that distinction, that assurance is the normal, ordinary consequence of saving faith. But it's not, sort of as you said, of the essence of saving faith. Now, when it came to the testimonies of saving faith or of the assurance of salvation, those tended to look the same, what I call the a posteriori, sort of after the fact, looking back on it, the reflex act, as you said, and the practical syllogism mm-hmm. of being able to look at your own life, especially in, say, for example, a practical syllogism goes something like this: God will save believers. Major premise. Minor premise: but I believe. Therefore, conclusion: God will save me. So that's the same sort of thing you see in Reformed theologians as well, including in the Dutch Further Reformation, many of the Dutch Pietists. He did that same thing. The differences with assurance for Arminius are not going to be found, in fact, so much there. Now, if both of them, whether it's Arminius or his Reformed contemporaries, they are not saying that's the foundation of salvation at all. It's when you start asking questions about the foundation of salvation, doctrine of God sort of questions, where you're going to see more of the differences. Mm. So I like to point out that Arminius, you know, on those things, whether it's sort of the sense of faith, testimony of the Holy Spirit, the presence of a struggle with sin, the desire to do good works, all those things, he's right in line with his colleagues and contemporaries on that.
So the difference is in the a priori grounding of assurance of salvation, not the a posteriori grounding of it?
Yeah, the things that are external to the inquirer. So those first things we mentioned are things that are subjective to the person. But I think for him and for the Reformed alike, they don't want to, you know, assurance is not finally based on looking in a mirror. It's looking to Christ and looking to God. So, yeah, God's promise of salvation to save believers, the fact that God's predestination for Arminius is going to be conditional upon faith, that God wills to save everyone, so that even if I don't have a future assurance, I can always, in Arminius's view, be assured that God really wants me to be saved. He wants me to be elect. He does not want me to be condemned. So that's where he would differ with his Reformed contemporaries there.
Keith, I was wondering mm-hmm. for our listeners if you might situate that very view within Arminius's Ordo Salutis. How might he compare to some other Reformed theologians, namely the Calvinists?
So for Ordo Salutis, I think that in many ways he's going to use the same categories. Mm. It all comes, the differences come in how you define them and describe them. Mm-hmm. So he's going to be perfectly comfortable with the order as it's basically laid out in Romans 8:29, for example, in other places. But it's the, it all comes in the definition or description of justification. What are the, are there conditions for predestination? What is the nature of grace? How does it operate? Those sorts of questions are where the differences really are going to lie.
Glenn, did you want?
Did that answer the question, or do I?
Yeah, no, that's helpful. It's interesting. We have to go much deeper than just a formal, comparison of ordo salutis. It's important to dig down and to see what is actually meant, term by term, doctrine by doctrine.
Well, and that's one of the things that his contemporaries didn't like about him. And to be sure that all Christian controversies have had problems with those they find heretical anyway, is they're using the language, the Orthodox language, but not in an Orthodox way. So that part, that aspect of the controversy is fairly typical.
If we can dig down into the Ordo Salutis a little bit here, and hear what how Arminius would describe faith, and how one comes to faith in Christ. In our circles, we define regeneration in such a way that it's the work of the Holy Spirit, renewing our hearts, renewing our wills, making us willing and able to believe in Christ. So we understand faith as a gift that is given to us from God, and that it's given only to the elect, and that no one has the ability in his own strength or power to believe in Christ, because the Holy Spirit must first make us willing and able to believe. Is that something that Arminius affirmed or rejected? What was his view of faith? Was it a gift freely given to the elect only by God, or something we do in our own power?
Yes, when you say faith there, I don't know if you mentioned the word grace, but of course that's infused in all of that, that faith is, as you say, a gift. All of the language you just used, Arminius would affirm as well, that it all begins with grace, that faith itself is a gift of God. The main difference there is that all we do is basically not resist it. So the nature of grace is, it all comes, I think that question comes back to, is grace irresistible or resistible? Mm-hmm. And for Arminius, it remains a gift that can be refused. He gives an analogy. There's in one of the documents, as I said, a lot of his stuff, just because of the debate, ended up being controversial sort of documents. There were charges against him and these propositions floating around in 16:8 that he taught such and such, these 31 propositions. So he responded to all 31 of them. One of them is that faith is not a gift, and he opposed that. He said, I don't teach that faith is not a gift. Faith is a gift. And he gives an analogy of a beggar. He says, now simply because I say that the beggar extends his hand and receives the gift doesn't mean that the alms that are given is no gift. You can't say, even in a sort of semi-Pelagian way, well, it was partly the giver and it was partly due to the recipient. We wouldn't say that about somebody who's begging for money and has no reason to receive it, yet the giver.
Right.
Anyway, so what, it's just that you don't, if you don't resist it, then that's in some ways basically what salvation is for Arminius, is not resisting the grace of God, which is the gift of faith. It's also the gift of perseverance, all of those things that can be resisted.
Now back to the, just quickly here, the illustration of the beggar reaching out his hand and accepting the gift. Not to press the analogy too far, but where would Arminius say the ability on the part of the beggar comes from? to accept the gift that God is extending to him? Is that something he has in himself, or is that a power that comes from outside of him that's also given to him?
Yeah, a very good question. He doesn't extend the analogy too much. In fact, one thing he says when he ends that analogy, he says, here's where the analogy breaks down. It takes far more and greater gifts of divine grace to accept faith, to be saved, than it does for the beggar to receive the alms from the donor. So if the analogy breaks down, it's because God actually does more for us than the almsgiver does for the beggar. So I think that would be one response of his. The other would be, again, to emphasize that it's not a positive action that the person is doing to receive the alms, but it's basically, again, not resisting the gift. So where that is still a passive thing, in other words, simply to receive it. But where that comes from, I mean, it's still the Holy Spirit who comes in beforehand, sort of prevenient grace there, comes in and offers that gift. And if a person does not resist it, then more gifts will be offered, and so on.
But the prevenient grace, as you mentioned, is resistible, correct?
Yeah.
Obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
All the way through to the end, from beginning to end. Yep. Mm-hmm. So he would say grace does everything. When you ask, what does grace do? It comes in beforehand. It changes the heart, changes the will, prepares the person for faith, gives faith. All those things, he said, I acknowledge that grace does all the things that Calvin says grace does. The main difference, the only difference, he says, is that all of those gifts are resistible along the way, but it still requires all of those things for salvation.
Right, right. So tying it back around to the idea of assurance, and I'm trying to make the connection without it kind of sounding like it's a gotcha type question, Keith, because that's not what we're here for. But I'm just trying to see the way in which Arminius would tie this back around, particularly relative to his doctrine of assurance. And so if faith or if grace then is something that all the way to the end is in fact resistible, wherein then lies the assurance that I won't in fact resist grace even up to the last moment? Does that make sense? It's not a gotcha question, but it's one of those things where as a Calvinist we're trying to think through it consistently and just wondering where Arminius, because I'm sure he had a response, I'm sure this was raised in the day, how he would have responded to that question.
Yeah. So two things preliminarily here. One is, first of all, if you're getting anybody, you're getting Arminius, not me. So that's a good thing. And two, that's a fair question, but Arminius will have a gotcha back. So just be prepared for that. It's appropriate.
Very,
time.
Very good. Fair enough.
Yeah, because it's definitely a fair question. Yeah, you don't have that, as far as I can tell. Now, some of these questions I'm extrapolating a little bit, but that I don't know a passage where Arminius deals with that specific question and answers it. But this is all consistent with what he says, and I think definitely what he would say about it. You do not have future assurance or certainty that you're going to be saved finally, that you're going to continue and persevere in that. So one cannot know 20 years down the road whether he will remain faithful or not. What you do have in Arminius' view, so that does seem to undermine it, yeah. What you do have, he would say, that strengthens it and certainly not just balances it out, but balances it in favor of his position here. You do have a present assurance that, at least in his judgment, the Reformed don't have. That is, that God really does want me to be saved. If I'm not saved, then it's because I resisted. It's not because God didn't offer me and want me to have the gift of grace. So there's the one point. The second is that with, again, Calvin's what he calls temporary faith, Simon Magus is the prime example there. Calvin says, here's a guy who truly did think he believed. So it wasn't even self-deception. It was, if you had asked Simon at the moment, are you a sincere believer, he would have said yes. In other words, he would have passed the practical syllogism, the reflex act of faith, and said, yes, I am. But that was a temporary faith that God then withdrew from him. So even on that score, you can't be assured of your present or your enduring future assurance and position in the faith, in the covenant, on his view here. What you do have with Arminius' view is a really certain present assurance. But then I think it's sort of like, now here's certainly like something Arminius didn't say, but is, I would, the analogy I would give is sort of like a human relationship. So I'm, you know, if I'm married right now and am faithful to that covenant, I can't give assurance 20 years down the road that I'm going to remain faithful to that covenant. But I know I am now. I know I have no intentions. You know, I've got an experience there of remaining faithful to it and so on. And that doesn't give me sort of anxiety now. It just means I don't become, again, secure or negligent in that relationship or in that covenant. Does that help?
Yeah, that's helpful, Keith. Just a quick follow-up. It seems, thinking through this with you as you have are explaining it to us, that it's Arminius' understanding of the resistibility of the grace of God, not only prevenient grace of God, but the ongoing work of God's grace in the life of the believer, leads him to reject the doctrine of the perseverance, the final perseverance of the saints. So I'm wondering if that's accurate, and also just to make sure that we are actually understand Arminius correct, that he would say that a truly regenerated person who has sincere, genuine, true faith and is in a state of justification can lose his justification, can fall out of that state completely and commit full final apostasy. Is that accurate?
Yes. There's disagreement among interpreters of Arminius on this. He is famously ambiguous. And the most ambiguous place he is about that question of perseverance is in the Declaration of Sentiments. And that is, if anybody's going to read one thing of Arminius, and I would recommend it, Declaration of Sentiments is the place to go. Unfortunately, if anyone is exposed to Arminius himself, they'll read that and then stop there, including many interpreters of Arminius, and not dig further. So they take the rather ambiguous statement there where he says, I haven't finally decided on all this, and make their point from that. They also take these 19th century translations, which do not do justice to a distinction he's making between the possibility of falling away and the actuality of falling away. So there's a confusion even in the English translation there. So all that has, I think, lent a lot of confusion to what does Arminius actually believe on this. It's my belief that he does think a person who is truly a believer and is in a state of justification can reject that. He has several passages that talk about this. He gives examples from Scripture, David, Peter, after their grievous sins, he thinks we're in that sort of state, where they can, of course, through God's grace, be restored back into relationship. He thinks it can, if grace is resistible at the beginning, then it's resistible during the process of salvation, including all the way into what we would call perseverance and sanctification.
Mm-hmm.
He does think it's resistible. It's not that there's a magic moment where it becomes, in this life anyway, an irresistible gift. It's something that can be rejected to one's detriment later on. Now, he does not, because he is so unwilling in many ways to elaborate on that, I think it's pretty clear, and he does talk about distinctions in different degrees of sin. It is not something that happens often. You know, he doesn't say this, but you get the sense of this is a decisive, deliberate choice that someone makes to renounce Christ, or the sin, what he calls out of malice, sort of malicious, out of hatred for Christ, someone who says basically, no, I don't care about good works or the fact that this is grievous sin. I don't feel sorry about it at all on any level. Then it's inconsistent with the sort of saving faith that would be a testimony of election and of salvation. So sins out of weakness, you know, those sorts of things that he admits, yeah, do characterize in many ways this continual struggle with sin in the Christian life. Those things do not take one out of that state of grace and justification. It's a deliberate will and act that does that.
You mentioned, Keith, earlier the Calvin versus the Calvinist thesis. Is there a similar thing for Arminius versus the Arminians?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And this one, in fact, I think holds even better than the old extreme versions of Calvin versus the Calvinists. There is actually the Arminius versus the Arminians thesis. That holds water a lot better. The Dutch Arminians quickly, and their opponents, in fact, quickly forget about Arminius. Now, his writings are being engaged by some, but after he dies in 1609, the controversy continues without him in many ways. So it's not that no one's reading him, but the controversies go on. By mid-17th century, on most of the Dutch Arminians, the Remonstrants, have accepted many of the principles of enlightenment, which comes along with, or the corollaries to that are exalted view of human reason, optimistic view of human nature after the fall, sometimes not explicitly anti-Trinitarian, but not explicitly Trinitarian as well. On all of those things, Arminius would certainly be closer to the Reformed and absolutely Reformed and Orthodox, little Orthodox on all of those matters. So you have very quick discontinuity there, which you have in some Reformed churches as well, many Reformed theologians by the end of the 17th century accepting Enlightenment principles, so it's not something peculiar to Arminianism. In England, Arminian basically, and in other places, becomes a cipher for anti-Calvinism. So it doesn't mean that you are a disciple of Arminius. It doesn't even mean you've read Arminius to be an Arminian, quote unquote. So those Arminians and then Wesleyan Arminians in the 18th century on have no genealogical relationship to Arminius. They definitely emphasize things other than he emphasized, but still used the name as many evangelicals do today, Arminian, without ever having read him or know or even care too much what Arminius himself thinks.
To follow up on this, Keith, this distinction between Arminius and the Arminians, is that some of what you have written on, for example, in your article on the new perspective on Arminius?
Yeah, a little bit of that. That's not the focus of that so much. The focus of the new perspective, and that's language when applied to Arminius, at least that Richard Muller used first, is just to document that there has been a shift, sort of a resurgence of interest in Arminius, but also a shift in trying to view him a little more objectively. Reformed historians have classically, of course, been against Arminius, and that colors the way they look at Arminius's writings. Arminian theologians have, of course, seen him as the hero, and that's colored the way they see his biography and his theological works. So the point here is a sort of, at first, non-confessional historiography of, which I think is the most responsible way to do history anyway, is try to be as objective as possible. Now, the fact that we're even interested in Arminius one way or another, you know, you can't hide that. Of course, we bring interest to it from one side or the other when we're often looking at history, and especially the history of theology. But that doesn't mean we can't get into the mind or the shoes, let's say, of the person we're studying, even if we don't agree with that person. Mm-hmm. So the really basic point, main point being made in that article, but it's one that unfortunately is not well known enough to try to understand before moving on to the step of assessment and evaluation, which must be done also, but it can't be done without a proper understanding or attempt at understanding first. And that's where a lot of evangelicals and theologians, Calvinist or otherwise, have, I think, not done a service to those we think of as our theological opponents. So let's actually see what they said and why they said it first. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is a bit anecdotal. I hope it's not out of place. But as a graduate from Westminster Theological Seminary, a Reformed institution, same seminary that Camden went to and Jim, I don't recall ever reading any of the original sources of Arminius, but I heard a great deal about Arminius and Arminianism, of course, at that seminary. And the way you have articulated Arminius' doctrine of salvation to us today is to the letter exactly like we were taught it at Westminster Seminary. And I don't know that that's the case in every Reformed seminary, but I don't think we were presented a caricature of Arminius at Westminster.
And there could be a difference between sometimes, you know, what might be taught in a classroom is maybe not what is heard and appropriated always. And certainly there's a pop-level theology of just Arminius says this or that or the other, and we can conflate the Arminians and even just our assumption of what Arminians, whoever they may be, view, and just conflate that with what Arminius actually taught, not even having ever read him. Mm-hmm. Keith, I really appreciated your article on the new perspective on Arminius, and it was helpful, and it was a good reminder that we need to do due diligence before we just whip off on whatever so-and-so or whoever so-and-so actually taught.
Right, and testimony to that is you guys having this as a topic, so I think that's great. And just anecdotally also, at Calvin Seminary, Richard Muller, in his MDiv classes that I would be a teaching assistant for, he had his Reformation, Post-Reformation survey class read Arminius. So it's great to get, as you say, to testify. I think it's probably, again, whether it's a Reformed or non-Reformed seminary, it's probably mostly caricature. So it's good to hear that there's accurate teaching going on, even when the students aren't engaging the primary sources. But Richard certainly would have the students, most of whom were preparing for ministry in Reformed churches, which he himself, of course, advocated. Read Arminius, so they didn't get out with having exposure to that. So I think it's a good thing,
Speaking of just caricatures of Arminius, I know he's been vilified and maligned many times throughout church history, and particularly in Reformed traditions. Arminius has basically been accused of nearly every theological error under the sun. John Wesley said one time that if you say this man is an Arminian, it has the same effect on people as to say that this man is a mad dog. And I want to kind of get back to that connection between, I think there is some sort of theological connection between Arminius and Wesley. From my reading of it, in particular, there's a biography out there on John Wesley that was written by Ian Murray, which was, for me, was eye-opening just to get into the mind of Wesley's soteriology. It seems to me like Arminius had a tremendous influence on Wesley. And I'm just wondering, I know Wesley taught that an unregenerate man can't believe and he has to have, he has to be given the gift of faith by God, which God gives to him through his work of prevenient grace. And Wesley would vehemently deny the charge of semi-Pelagianism or synergism. And I'm sure that Arminius would have denied semi-Pelagianism too, if that would have been... if he would have been were to be accused of that. But I'm wondering, just if do you think there's any merit at all to the charge of synergism with regard to Arminius' doctrine of salvation? Just the cooperative element of, you put it earlier that he doesn't actively that the unregenerate person isn't actively cooperating with prevenient grace, but not actively resisting it. So he's passive in a sense. That's the way you stated it earlier, I believe. But there still does, not only in the initial stages of a person's salvation, the beginning of the work of the Spirit in the heart, but in the ongoing life of the Christian, how there's some sort of cooperative, synergistic dimension to it by which the believer can ultimately lose his salvation. So, I mean, just the question is, do you personally think there's any merit at all to the charge of synergism with regard to Arminius' doctrine of salvation?
Yeah, I like the, is there merit to the charge? Yeah, there's half merit, maybe.
Semi-merit to the charge.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So let me take both terms there. Semi-Pelagian is a term that was invented in the 16th century to, for those who subscribe to unconditional predestination, to attack their opponents. Mm-hmm. And then later it was applied to 5th, 6th century folk.
Cassianism?
Yeah, that's right. So Arminius was accused of semi-Pelagianism. It's one of the things, charges that he answers. As you indicate, he denies the charge. What he says is, because this is a recent term in his own day, he says, we invent these terms, semi, which means half, is Latin for half, half-Pelagianism. Where are we going to invent, one-quarter, one-third Pelagianism? And what he saw is a Pelagius, in his extreme, basically crass way of putting his doctrines, as a heresy. The complete opposite of that continuum or spectrum is probably also a heresy. If you define a heresy as concentrating on one kernel of truth and exalting it and emphasizing it so much to the exclusion of the other side of the paradox, and not allowing the tension there. Of course, the tension in question here is divine grace and human freedom. All Christian theologians want to maintain some sort of, at least, idea of human free will and responsibility, particularly for sin. So he's saying, if I'm anywhere on that spectrum besides the opposite extreme of Pelagius, I guess it's half or quarter or one eighth Pelagianism. They see that as basically just an insult that doesn't get at the heart of the issue. Synergism, I think, is a little trickier. All that is, I mean, just taking the definition of the word, as you said, it's cooperation. It's Latin equivalent. So is there cooperation? Some Arminian theologians deny that Arminius was a synergist in that sense. He doesn't use that word. That's another word that was basically invented in the 16th century in the Lutheran controversy, if I'm not mistaken, over predestination, same sort of political context as semi-Pelagian. He, I don't think, was accused of synergism and used that word, but a certain definition of it he would reject. The basic definition, just what the word means, do we cooperate in the sense of not resisting? I'm comfortable with that understanding, calling Arminius a synergist, if that's understood correctly. If it means we do half and God does half and we are both working for justification and so forth, then no. But if it simply means we don't resist in that sense of cooperation, that Christ knocks and we answer the door or whatever, yeah, as long as you understand that for him, the beginning of faith, the beginning of salvation comes from God. And that's the same with semi-Pelagianism. It depends on how you define it. If it means, as most want to define it, most historians, that the beginning of salvation is with humanity, the human will, and then God gives grace to that initial act of faith or inclination toward God, then no, Arminius is no semi-Pelagian. Mm-hmm. And synergism means that, then he's no synergist. So it all comes to the definition. They tend to be sort of polemical terms that don't get defined, but just thrown out there.
Mm-hmm. You took maybe an illustration would be helpful. It sounds like a person, if he were in a river that had a very strong current moving in a direction, as long as he's not actively resisting that, he's going to move in that direction.
Yeah, that may be a good way to put it. Yeah.
Keith, this has been a fascinating discussion. I really appreciate it. I'm sure the listeners will have learned and will want to follow up. But we want to thank you not only for all the academic work you've done in the past and will continue to do, but thank you for this morning for taking the time to join us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thank you again for invitation.
Absolutely. Well, we would love to speak with you again. Of course, if the listeners would like to follow up, you can find out a bunch of information at austingrad.edu. That's not some sort of new Russian colony, Austingrad, but it's short for the Austin Graduate School of Theology at austingrad.edu. And there's information about the Dr. Stanglin's CV and links to different articles, and there are several out there that you're going to want to read, of course, and his books as well. Of course, you can find out information about us at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs, our events, lots of new posts. We have a lot of stuff going on the website, and we have some great help now from our friend Dan Ragusa, who is acting as our managing editor, so we're very thankful for him and looking forward to publishing a lot more in the near future. So stay tuned and visit us online at reformedforum.org. I want to thank everybody for listening and hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.